This is lecture three. So, by the end of this lecture, we will, the goal is to be able to fully specify, precisely specify the, you know, laws of nature as we best understand them at the moment, the standard model of particle physics, but we'll be specifying them in a very, in sort of their most compact, in the most compact way we know how to do it at the moment. And then it'll be at that level of compactness, it will be at first glance maybe largely incomprehensible. And so we're going to need the next lecture or so to unpack it and turn it into, you know, make it concrete enough that you can actually work with it and calculate things. Okay, so to get there, we want to understand, we first need to understand a little bit more about Yang-Mills theory. So last time, so let's just quickly recap what happened last time. So the goal was to try to, so the standard model is a gauge theory. We said that's a theory where, so it's characterized by some Lagrangian L or some action S, the integral of L, which has a local symmetry. So in other words, you send the fields to some transformed version of themselves, and the transformation depends on the space-time coordinate. It's not a constant. And the idea is we're trying to write down a Lagrangian or an action that is invariant under that sort of transformation. That's what a gauge theory is. And we drew this distinction between two types of gauge theories, abelian and non-abelian. Okay, abelian just means that two different symmetry transformations, U1 and U2, commute with each other. Non-abelian is when they don't. And so, again, just as a matter of terminology, we, you know, there's a bunch of different names that you'll hear people call an abelian gauge theory. It's also called Maxwell theory because it is also, it's basically the, classically, it's the electrodynamic theory that Maxwell found, it's equivalent to it, or QED, quantum electrodynamics, when you do the quantum theory, or another way to say it is that it's a U1 gauge theory because U1 is usually the commutative group that you're talking about when you deal with a gauge theory, an abelian gauge theory. Okay, and similarly, this guy has a bunch of names that I may slip in and out of depending on. And so just to clarify, so a non-abelian gauge theory is also usually called a Yang-Mills theory because it was the generalization of Maxwell theory found by Yang and Mills in the 50s. Or also, instead of a U1 gauge theory, you might call it a UN gauge theory or an SUN gauge theory or an SON gauge theory, depending on what group, what Lie group, non-abelian Lie group, this transformation matrix is drawn from. Okay, and so, we said, you know, basically one way to introduce the topic is to say, well, in your first course on QFT, you met the Lagrangian for a free scalar field, or for a free fermion field, and so now the way we got the way we want to make this thing into a gauge invariant theory that is invariant when we take phi, I'll just focus on the scalar case, when we take our scalar field and transform it to something times phi, where the something depends on x. Okay, and first we looked at the case, the abelian case, where this was just, this scalar field was just a single complex number living over every point in space-time. And in that case, there's not much we can do here. We're acting on a single complex number. So the abelian case is where you just transform it by a complex, multiply it by another complex number, a complex phase, e to the I alpha. And again, alpha is a function of x. And then to generalize to the non-abelian case, we said, well, instead of taking phi to be a single complex number over each point in space-time, we'll take it to be a column vector of r complex numbers. And then the generalization is that, so now this is an r component vector. And so when we map it, instead of hitting it with a single complex number, we have this fancier option. We can hit it with an r by r matrix of complex numbers. Okay, and which again depends on the space-time coordinate at x. And so the question is how to make that, how to write down an invariant Lagrangian. And so we saw that the trick was just like in GR, just like E and M, we have to replace the partial derivative everywhere it appears in that action by the covariant derivative. Okay, which is just the partial derivative plus some extra stuff. An extra connection term. And the point of this thing is that we wanted to ensure that when we took the derivative of the field, the covariant derivative, the point of the covariant derivative is that now when we transform this object, when we send phi to u phi, we want d mu phi to also go to u d mu phi. Or in other words, if you think about it, so this is phi goes to u phi, and so, okay, so phi d phi goes to d prime phi prime, which we want to be equal to this. But on the other hand, we know that phi prime is u phi, so this is d prime times u phi. Okay, so that's saying that this transformation law is equivalent, if you look here, to saying that d, the covariant derivative, as an operator, transforms to u, you know, transforms to d mu prime, which is u d mu u inverse, because then we have u d mu u inverse, the u inverse kills the u, and we get the expression that we want. Okay, so the point of introducing this guy is so that we can make a derivative operator that transforms like this. And we saw that the way that in order to achieve this, this guy has to have a certain transformation property. So it has to transform like u a mu u inverse plus I over g partial mu u times u inverse. Okay, so if it was just this part, a mu would transform like a nice tensor with two indices, sort of up index, which is getting hit by u, and down index, which is getting hit by u inverse, in analogy with the tensor transformation laws you encounter in GR. But instead, we take it to transform in this non-tensorial way so that the derivative does transform like a tensor. Okay, but then in the actual laws of nature describing our universe, a mu is not just some mathematical abstraction. It appears to be its own independent physical degree of freedom. The particles that carry this force actually run around in the lab. And so to describe any dynamical thing, we need to write down a Lagrangian that includes a kinetic term for that thing. And so how will we write down the kinetic term for this guy? Well, we're going to have trouble writing it down directly in terms of A because it doesn't transform like a tensor. But we saw that if we instead consider the, if we want to make a tensor out of it, what we do is we look at the commutator of two covariant derivatives acting on our field, and that turns out to be equal to all the derivatives turn out to drop out, all the derivatives that acted on phi turn out to cancel out in this expression, and we end up with just an expression which is some tensor f mu nu acting on phi, where this tensor, if you just plug this expression into here, you find that this tensor is given by this expression, d mu a nu minus d nu a mu plus ig times the commutator of a mu and a nu. And again, this is one way to, a mathematician would say this is the curvature of this connection, and a physicist would say this is the field strength associated with that gauge field. Okay, and now you can see from this expression, we know how the covariant derivative d times phi transforms. It transforms like a tensor, and so when we hit that, it transforms just like phi did, and so now when we hit that thing which transformed just like phi with another d, it still transforms like phi, so the covariant derivative preserves that property, that it transforms tensorially. So this whole thing is going to transform under a gauge transformation by just picking up a u in front. And so this side must as well, okay, but this guy just picks up a u when we transform. And so in order for the whole right-hand side to transform like that, it must be that f transforms like in a nice tensorial way, u times f mu nu times u inverse. And you can check that if you just take this transformation law for A and plug it into this expression for f, you'll find that it does transform like this. And so that is exactly what we wanted. We wanted to be able to write down a kinetic term for A, but to do that first, we had to find a nice tensor that we could build out of A. Okay, good, we found it. And so then the last step in the last lecture was we wrote down the corresponding action for that guy. Let's see, is the bottom of that board visible? So we wrote down the corresponding action. We said, okay, great. So if F transforms like that, then the following generalization of the usual Maxwell action works. We said the usual Maxwell action in ordinary E and M, everything commutes with everything. So U just passes right through F, hits U inverse, and cancels it. So in other words, F is invariant under an ordinary gauge transformation in electromagnetism, Abelian gauge theory. So F is invariant under gauge transformations, but it's still not invariant under Lorentz transformations. It has two indices hanging here. So we can contract it with another F to soak up those indices. And now this thing is invariant under both gauge transformations and Lorentz transformations. Great. It's a good term we can write down in the action. And this is nothing but the action for ordinary electromagnetism. And now the only difference with Yang-Mills is that now it's not invariant under a gauge transformation. F is not invariant. Instead, it transforms like a tensor. But that's no problem. So if we imagine now how this thing transforms, well, now it's Lorentz invariant. And now under a gauge transformation, we get u times u inverse. And u times u inverse, this u inverse u cancels. We have an overall u and u inverse here that we need to take care of. But if we regard this as some matrix expression at every point in space, and we just take the trace of that product of matrices, We know that the trace has this cyclic property that you can move a matrix from the beginning around to the end without changing the trace. And so we move the U around here, it cancels the U inverse. And so great, this thing is now invariant. And so we ended by just saying, great, well, now we've figured out how to write down the gauge theory corresponding to those theories we started with. So in the scalar case, we started with, maybe I'll just bring that board down. No, not that board, sorry. So, great, now everything is simple. We just change every partial to a capital D here. And then we just add the Yang-Mills action here, the Yang-Mills action for the gauge field. And voila, we have successfully written down non-abelian gauge theory. This is the non-abelian gauge theory of a scalar field coupled to a non-abelian gauge field. And this is the Yang-Mills theory for spinner field coupled to a non-abelian gauge field. So yeah, either of these things would be Yang-Mills theories. This is in some sense the non-abelian generalization of QED. This is the non-abelian generalization of scalar QED. Okay, so that was where we got to at the end of last time. And so before I can specify the standard model for you, that was sort of the blitz introduction to Yang-Mills. It was at a rather abstract level. We need to just clarify a few points about those expressions before the specification for the standard model will make sense. Okay, but maybe before that, were there any questions about that? Yeah.
So A mu is a R by R matrix.
Yes.
Oh, that means that it's fine in A mu to be different in that way and transform differently.
Why do they transform in different ways?
Yeah.
That's part of what I'm about to explain now. Maybe can I explain that? Were there any other questions? So I will take a slightly meandering route to the answer to that question, but then if I haven't answered it by the time we take the mid-lecture break, I will think by that point that I've answered it, but then you'll have to decide whether I have answered it. You think I have, so. So let's just pause and make sure we understand what is going on. You see, the whole story, unfortunately, well, fortunately, depending on whether you like this sort of thing, it's got a lot of moving pieces you have to keep track of, but you know, it is what it is. It's the laws of nature that describe the universe, so let's try to get them all straight. So let's just first keep the following thing separate. So remember in order to specify a Yang-Mills theory, we begin by picking the gauge group, the group from which the local transformations will be drawn. Okay, so let's use capital G to denote that Lie group. And let's say an element of that Lie group is, I'll call it little g. Okay, and then we said any Lie group is, if you look at the tangent space, the Lie group is some manifold, where every point on the manifold is an element of the group. But if we look near the identity element, the tangent space is a vector space, and the product on the group induces a product on that vector space. So that little vector space is an algebra, it's a Lie algebra. So that is some associated Lie algebra G. I'll try to write it with curly G. So let's call an element of that Lie algebra x, okay? And we said, you know, that again, one way to say it is that this is the infinitesimal tangent vector near the origin for this group. And another way to say it is that g is the exponential of x. We exponentiate the Lie algebra elements to get the group. Okay, now since this is a vector space, we can expand it in a basis. So if this is a d-dimensional vector space, we can expand this in a basis with d basis vectors in it. So a mathematician would just write this like this. Okay, where these are real numbered coefficients, d of them, and these are the basis vectors of the Lie algebra, otherwise known as the generators of the Lie group G. Now, physicists prefer to put an I in front here so that this, you see, if we write G as the exponential of x, which is how a mathematician would write it, then as I was saying yesterday, the simple Lie groups, as I was saying yesterday and in the previous lecture, the simple Lie groups are you know, matrices that are anti-Hermitian. They might be real n by n matrices that are anti-Hermitian, or complex n by n, or quaternion n by n that are anti-Hermitian. So physicists would prefer to work with Hermitian matrices for historical reasons. So you can make an anti-Hermitian matrix into a Hermitian one by pulling out a factor of I. So that's what we do. Okay, so this was an anti-Hermitian guy, but we'll write it like I times a basis times coefficients times the same basis vectors as before, but just multiplied by minus I. So these are now Hermitian matrices instead of anti-Hermitian matrices. Okay, great. Now, so again, there's only two steps needed to define the Yang-Mills theory. Completely specify the theory. I need to tell you, step one, I need to choose my group G. And step two, I need to choose the representation under which the matter fields are going to transform. I need to choose some representation of G. And in principle, once I've told you those two bits of information, you can write down the action for that corresponding theory. We got to get clear about that before we do it. So again, the representation of a group G is a map where we associate every element G in the Lie group with a corresponding matrix U of G. And if this is an R-dimensional, little r-dimensional representation, then this is an R by R matrix. Okay? That every element of the group, we're going to associate an R by R matrix. Oh, by the way, I should have mentioned something. Okay, first of all, sorry, I'm going to change notation. I'm going to, instead of calling this index A, I'm going to call it M, because I want to call this index A. So there's something potentially confusing that you want to keep clear about, which is that, so this index, remember, this index runs from 1 to D, which is the dimension of this vector space, the Lie group G. Okay, so that's some this index runs from 1 to D, and that D has nothing to do with the representation. For a fixed Lie algebra, for a fixed Lie group, there is a fixed D, and I don't get to choose anything about it. So for example, SU2 is an example of a Lie group. So if G is SU2, then the dimension of that, the Lie algebra SU2 is a three-dimensional Lie algebra. Okay, so in that case, little d is equal to 3. There, this is a three-dimensional vector space. Okay, but then independently of that, I can choose a representation of this group. Okay, so for example, in the case of SU2, you know that there are representations that are trivial, one-dimensional representations that don't transform at all under the Lie group. But then there's two-dimensional, two-by-two representations, 3x3, 4x4, 5x5. There's an infinite number of representations, one for every integer n, and those correspond to the different spins of particles. So the 2x2 representation is how it is the representation under which a spin 1/2 particle transforms. The 3x3 representation is how a spin 1 particle transforms, etc. Okay, so we are going to choose an r-dimensional representation of G. So we're going to choose a map from U to some R by R matrix. And this R-dimensional representation of G will act on a corresponding R-dimensional vector space. And our matter field, phi, will be an element of that vector space. Okay, so that's our matter field, phi, is a vector in that vector space. So U is some R by, and so if we were just to explicitly add indices here, U is a matrix. It has two indices, A and B. And they act on this guy. This guy is a vector with the same dimension. So it has an index phi A. And so I'll try to stick to this notation where this index, which runs again over the dimension of the Lie algebra from 1 to D, I'll use letters like M and N for that. And then for this index, which runs from 1 to R, the dimension of the representation, I'll try to use these Latin letters from early in the alphabet. Okay, and so, okay, let me move this. And so, just as we could write this Lie group element as the exponential of a corresponding element of the abstract Lie algebra, when we take a representation of this element, we take this Lie group element and we represent it by an R by R matrix, again, we can write this R by R matrix as the exponential of the corresponding representation of this Lie algebra element. So here, previously, so if we rewrite x this way, okay, so we rewrite it as I times lambda m times the generators tm. Well, down here, we're the corresponding matrix representation, corresponding matrix to G is those same parameters, lambda A, times the corresponding, lambda M, times the corresponding, not the abstract generator of the Lie algebra, but its R by R representation. Okay, so maybe just to clarify, I'll put R by R in parentheses down here. Okay, so this is an R by R matrix. This is also an R by R matrix. Okay, so this carries some indices, A and B. So if you look through If you go back through the derivation that we did last time of what the connection should be like, how it should transform under a gauge transformation, what the corresponding field strengths should be like, you will find that A, the gauge field, that the connection you have to add to make the derivative covariance. So in other words, now you, with this new understanding, with this new, let's say, clarified understanding, you go back and now you say, okay, phi is this vector, which by assumption transforms like this. Okay, and now we want to define a covariant derivative acting on phi that also transforms like this. And so we do it by writing d mu as partial mu plus I g a mu. You go through that calculation to work out how it transforms. Well, you'll see that when you write out all the components, that what A should be, in order for the transformation to be right, is it should be expressible, expandable in terms of T mu, exactly like an element of the Lie algebra is. Okay, so A mu is, can be written like this. Okay, and more correctly, if phi transforms in an r-dimensional representation of the group, then when you put a mu in, then in this derivative, in the derivative, in the covariant derivative, you see in the abstract covariant derivative, the abstract covariant derivative depends on this abstract gauge field. But what concrete form it takes depends on what representation it acts on. Okay, so for example, this is something you may be familiar with from GR. In that case, you have, you know, the abstract covariant derivative, if you want, is entirely captured by the Christoffel symbol. But when you actually work out the covariant derivative acting on something, it depends on what it acts on. So for example, if it acts on a tensor with just one upper index, then when you expand out the covariant derivative, there's just one covariant derivative, then there's just one Christoffel symbol here, and it's contracted in a certain way, okay? It's contracted like, okay, but if this was an object with two indices, for example, okay, then you know this would expand out differently. It would be two copies of the covariant derivative appearing here, and you know the indices would be different on the covariant derivative depending on. So anyway, the details are not important. Hopefully you've seen something like that in GR, or will shortly. But so anyway, the exact same thing is true here. There's the abstract connection which connects you between vector spaces, different vector spaces in this vector bundle over the manifold. But the particular form of the connection that appears in the when the covariant derivative is acting on a particular field depends on what representation that field appears in. So, in other words, it corresponds in the obvious way. So here, when d mu is acting on a field that transforms in this representation R, then when I expand d mu out this way, secretly what I'm really doing is I'm expanding a mu like this, where this is the r by r representation of the generator. Okay, and so in short, this also is supposed to be the answer to to the question you asked before, which is that this guy is not, I don't get to choose it to be in the same representation as the field phi, and I don't get to choose it to be in any other arbitrary representation of my choice, because it has this property that it's expressible, it has to be expressible as a linear combination of the basis vectors for the Lie algebra, and so it has to transform in a way that's compatible with the basis vectors of the Lie algebra. And the basis vectors of the Lie algebra form a particular d-dimensional representation of this group called the adjoint representation, which transforms exactly like that with a U and a U inverse. So the answer to the question is that, unlike the matter fields where it is my free choice what representation they transform in, the gauge fields always transform in the adjoint representation of the group. They transform with this U inverse rule. Because ultimately they are valued in the Lie algebra, whose basis vectors, regardless of what representation we take of the Lie algebra, the basis vectors of the Lie algebra get mixed up into one another according to this adjoint representation. Okay? Okay? Okay, pause. What about now? Anybody? Jokes? Yes? Oh my god. So early in the course, too.
So I can make a drawing version?
Wonderful.
So it's the story of three persons. So we have a mathematician.
If this is good enough, you're basically hired for the whole class.
Okay. So we have an engineer, a mathematician, and a physicist. So they're taking a plane. Okay. Yeah, it looks like a plane. So they take a plane, but unfortunately they crash into the ocean and they go onto an island. And so they're disturbed, they're, oh, we crashed, we are all the only survivors, we have to get some food. So they see three cans that come from the plane, they find it coming from the ocean. They say, okay, we're three, let's each one of us take one can and get something away. We have to open them, but then we get some food. So they go each way, okay, good luck. They go on their part of the island. So the engineer finds a rock, say, okay, if I apply my rock here, if I have some torque, I can open the can. So he does like this, tack, and you open the can, it has something to it. The physicist is trying to think about something, say, okay, I can use thermodynamics. If I put a fire here, I'm heating up what's inside, the pressure gets bigger, it explodes, and then I get what's inside. So, cool, it does that, gets something to eat, that's cool. After some time, the engineer and the physicist meet, and they say, oh, you open your can, that's cool. I'm wondering what the mathematician is doing. So they go and find the mathematician, they see from far away, and he's only staring at the can, not moving. So, okay, curious, the can is still closed. They come closer and they hear that he's saying something. And as they come closer, they hear, suppose the can is open.
I thought you were going to say that they were going to like find the food outside the can and the mathematician inside it and he had performed an inversion or something like that.
Oh.
But anyway, that's okay, yes, very good. Thank you very much, yes. Ha. Huh. Really much more refreshing than what I was planning. I kid you not, planned a very depressing poem instead. So this was much more suited to the what was needed. That was great, thank you. Okay, so So good. So let's talk about the actual standard model. So again, the story is that, oops, I erased it. But so the story is that to specify the standard model, all I need to tell you is that it is a Yang-Mills theory, and I need to tell you what the symmetry group is, and then what representation the matter fields transform. Okay, good. So the gauge group will be SU3 times SU2 times U1. So let's pause for a moment to make sure we know what that means. So what does it mean to have the gauge? So we've met SU3 or SU2 or U1 individually. For example, this guy we said was just the set of all, this is the group of all 3x3 complex matrices that are unitary, meaning that U dagger is equal to U inverse, and special in the sense that their determinant is equal to 1. And these similarly for 2x2, and this is just the group of complex phases e to the I alpha. So what does it mean to take the product of the three? Well, it just means that, so an element of this group, so G, an element of the product group, is just, so if we call an element of this group G3, and an element of this group G2, and an element of this group G1, then an element of the product group is just a triple consisting of three components, G3, G2, and G1. And so, you know, if we have two elements of this group, we know how to multiply them. We just take the matrices and we multiply them. G3 and two elements, G3 and G3 prime, for example. Okay, so then what if we have two elements of this group, G and G prime? Okay, G prime might be G3 prime, G2 prime, G1 prime. So what is the product of G times G prime? Well, it's just the simple thing where you multiply the components individually. Okay, so the three components of this is a new element of that group, and its components are just G3, G3 prime, G2, G2 prime, G1, G1 prime. So in other words, the groups don't talk to each other directly. They're essentially independent of each other. And so for practical purposes, when we're actually analyzing the physics of this theory or writing down its Lagrangian, then, you know, we can consider the groups one at a time. Stated another way, we can just consider, you know, we can consider one at a time an element like where we take a non-trivial element from SU3, but then trivial elements from SU2 and U1. So that we would just call an SU3 transformation. Or if we just took a non-trivial element from G2 and a trivial element from the other, the identity element which does nothing from the other two parts of the group, that would just be an SU2 transformation we're considering on its own. And we'll be able to extract everything we need to know about the math and physics of the theory, just considering the groups separately like that. Okay, good. So now, next, what about the representation? So for that, let's make a little table here. Okay, this table is somehow maybe the most important takeaway from this course. The table of, it's the almost completely unexplained, but almost certainly correct table of all the matter fields in the universe and how they transform under the gauge symmetry of the standard model. So your first, you know, job, in some sense, one of the main goals of the first half of the class is just to understand clearly in your mind what this table is saying and how to use it to predict everything you might want to predict about this. Results of the standard model. And then if you want the second half of the course, the viewpoint is more, where does this table come from? That's not the whole thing, but that's one of the central goals in Beyond the Standard Model Physics, is ideally to explain why is this table the way it is. Currently, we've determined this table by experiment, but no one knows why it is the way it is. Or at least no one yet agrees upon the answer to why it is the way it is. Okay, so what are the fields in the standard model? Whoops, I'm going to need one more line, sorry. Okay, so let me just fill in the table and then we'll unpack what it says. Okay, so first I'm going to write down the fermion fields, the spin 1/2 fields, and then at the bottom, then after that I'll write down the spin 0 fields. So first the fermion fields, then the scalar fields. So the fermion fields. Well, there are 5 rows of them. There's the left-handed quark doublet, okay, and it turns out to come in 3 copies, 3 generations. Well, forget about that for a second. So there's a left-handed quark doublet, which we will later write as a 2-component vector, up left and down left, up quark and the down quark. Then there is the corresponding right-handed quarks, U right and D right. Okay, those are all the quarks. Then there are the corresponding leptons. So just like there was the left-handed quark doublet, there's a left-handed lepton doublet, which we will later write. We call it a doublet because we will later write it as this 2-component vector consisting of the left-handed neutrino and the left-handed electron. And then there are the corresponding right-handed leptons, nu right and E right. Okay, well, not quite, because no one has ever yet directly detected nu right, so we are not sure that it is there. So in this traditional standard model, this line is not actually present. So the traditional standard model, which everyone thought was right, let's say prior to, well, certainly prior to 1980, and then, well, and it still could be right, has only those 5 fermions with this line crossed out. But I will write it for reasons that we'll see later in the course, and I would say it's more likely than there that it's more likely than not that that line is present, which we seem to have various lines of indirect evidence that it is, but strictly speaking, we have no direct evidence that that line is there, so it may or may not be there. So the standard model is without this line. There's these 5 lines of fermions, but the other thing is I wanted to write it to also to emphasize the pattern, that there's a sort of similar pattern between the quarks and leptons, which continues. Okay, so those are all the fermions in the standard model. Well, there's one thing I didn't mention here, which is that for some currently unexplained reason, this whole pattern of fermions comes in 3 copies. Okay, so each of these guys has a little index, I, the so-called family index or generation index, which runs from 1 to 3. And so in addition to the up quark, there are 2 other, this is really a triplet of particles, the up quark, the charm quark, and the top quark, 3 particles that are identical as far as this table is concerned. Okay, so let's fill in the table for these guys, and then we'll get to the final row, which is the scalar field. So these 3 particles all transform as the 3-dimensional representation of SU3, and these guys all don't transform under SU3. They're completely inert. So you do an SU3 transformation to the quarks, but then in order for the standard model Lagrangian to be invariant, you do nothing to the lepton fields. So mathematically, that's saying that these guys transform in the trivial or 1-dimensional representation of the of SU3. Okay. Under SU2, it turns out that the left-handed fermions do transform. They transform as the 2-dimensional representation of SU2. Whereas all of the right-handed guys, for some reason, don't transform. Okay, that's another important mystery about the standard model. Why is it that the left-handed fermions transform as doublets and the right-handed fermions don't transform? And then finally, there is the there is U1. Now, unfortunately, there's a confusing the representations of U1 are notated in a different way than the representations of SU3 and SU2. So for non-abelian groups, usually the notation is to label each representation by the dimension of that representation. So this guy, this is the little r that we were using before. So this is a two-dimensional representation, one-dimensional representation. For U1, we instead label, we fill in this table according, U1 only has one-dimensional representations. And so instead we label the fields by their U1 charges. This is analogous to the electromagnetic force, because the electromagnetic force is also a U1 gauge theory. So this is not electromagnetism, but it's analogous. We'll get to know it better. But this is the so-called hypercharge instead. And so each of these fields can have, just like normal particles can have different particles can have different electric charges. You know, the neutron has zero electric charge, the electron has minus one. So fields have different hypercharges, and so these are the hypercharges. The left-handed quark has hypercharge 1/6, the up quark has hypercharge 2/3, the down quark minus 1/3, the left-handed lepton doublet minus 1/2, the neutrino, if it exists, has zero, and the right-handed electron has minus 1. Okay, and then finally, So much for the fermions. We've now completely filled in everything I need to tell you about them in principle. And that is at least from a logical standpoint. And then for the scalars, there's just one line. Okay, again, it's another unexplained fact about the standard model that there's 6 lines worth of fermions and 1 line worth of scalars. No logic compels that to be the case. This is just some fact that we have figured out from experiment, but is so far unexplained. So fine, there's one line in the table, which is a scalar field. And so its charges are, it's a 1, it doesn't transform under SU3. It's a 1 here, sorry, it's a 2 here. It does transform as a doublet under SU2. And its hypercharge is plus 1/2. Okay, so now let me just say a little bit more by what I mean when I say this is the representation. You know, so what I'm saying is that we had considered the picture that I drew when I was introducing Yang-Mills theory. Okay, is it, so I had vowed to stop on time. Now we did start 5 minutes late. I'm gonna go 5 minutes more, is that okay? Because we started late. Just to say I'm not breaking my vow right from the get-go. So we had described the transition from ordinary field, from U1 gauge theory to Yang-Mills theory by saying, as the transition from considering, you know, one scalar field, a single scalar field, so one complex number living above each point in space, to R, you know, to an R component vector. Okay. So that's and just for simplicity, we had treated the fermion fields and scalar fields. Well, forget about the fermion fields for a second. Let's think about the scalar fields. So I described this fact that now, this lies in an R-dimensional representation of the gauge group, and so it transforms like this. Okay, this R-component vector transforms to another R-component vector. What we hadn't discussed was whether this matrix was, whether this representation was reducible or irreducible. So hopefully you've met this concept before, but just in case, let me just review, you know. So when you find a when you write down a representation of a group, it may be reducible or irreducible. If it is reducible, that means that it is possible to choose, you know, this is a vector space, so we can always, it's the choice of the basis in that vector space is arbitrary. We're always free to choose a different basis, which might simplify the problem in one way or another. If we can make a change of basis so that this matrix U becomes block diagonal, so it only has non-zero, so that no matter what group element we choose, the corresponding matrix U has only non-zero elements here and here, whereas the off-diagonal blocks are zero, then that is said to be a reducible representation. Okay, we've reduced the R-dimensional representation into two smaller representations, R1 and R2 here. Okay. And we usually say that that the reducible representation, in that case, we would say that the reducible representation R is the direct sum of two smaller representations, R1 and R2. Now, if we cannot, if there's no change of basis that we can do to further reduce this thing, okay, it could be that maybe we could further reduce this thing and break R1 down into even smaller components. But if we can't do that, if there's no change of basis that does that, and we're always stuck with using this full matrix, R1 by R1 matrix, then we say R1 and R2 are irreducible representations. Okay, so the story with the standard model is just that instead of a single scalar field or a single fermion field living above each point in space, we have a column of several scalar fields and several fermion fields lying above each point in space. In some sense, there are two scalar fields and 96 or 48, let's say 48 fermion fields lying above each point in space. Okay, so this matrix now is, if you want, phi is transforming with a 2x2 representation. The scalar fields in the standard model are transforming with some, there's two of them, and so their matrix U is some 2x2 complex matrix. Meanwhile, the fermions, there's 48 of them, so they're transforming with some 48x48 matrix. Okay, and this matrix, this 2x2 matrix, is irreducible. That's why there's only one line here for the scalar fields. This table is showing you how all the different irreducible components. This table, we've already gone to a basis that of irreducible representations. And so each row is a different irreducible representation in the standard model. So the scalars, there's only one irreducible representation. So this 2x2 cannot be broken down into block diagonal form. But this 48x48 matrix can, like crazy. Okay, so it turns out that that when you break it down, there are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 × 3 different blocks that appear. Okay? So it's like this. You have this 48x48 matrix. To just say that a little bit more, and then this is the last thing, and I'll stop. So you have this 48x48 matrix, and you break it down into three identical 16x16 matrices, okay? Or 15x15, sorry. 16 or 15, depending on whether we include this row or not. Okay, if we don't include this row, yeah, sorry. I'm being confusing, sorry. In the standard model, okay, I've put this here to make you aware I'm gonna include this later, but let's forget about this guy for a second. And everything else I will say in this lecture, we'll imagine that this row is not present. So we'll be talking about the traditional standard model that received the Nobel Prize in 1979. Okay, in that case, I should have said this is a 45x45 matrix. There are 45 different fermion fields living above each point in space-time. That 45x45 matrix can first be broken down into a 15x15x15 block diagonal matrix. Okay, that breakdown corresponds to this index I. Okay, when we go into that basis, these are the first generation of standard model fermions. This is acting on some 45 component vector, where the top 15 components are the so-called first generation. The next 15 components are the so-called second generation, and the third 15 components are the third generation. And again, the key thing about this is not just that these have the same sizes, but they turn out to be the identical matrices. Whatever whatever further you can choose a basis where these matrices are identical. But they can be further reduced. Each of these can be reduced into five blocks. And those are these five rows. Okay. So there's a let me stop there. So that's the in principle, we've specified the representation of the standard model and the gauge group. So now in principle, I don't need to tell you anything more. The standard model is just the most general action you can write down that is invariant, that is Lorentz invariant, and also has this local gauge symmetry with the fields transforming in this representation. But then next time we'll actually try to write that down and we'll learn a lot about it by doing that. Okay, any questions? Okay, oh yes. Yes. Yes.
I think in 42 we saw that the Adjoint representation transforms is only the first term.
That's absolutely right. So if it's so yes, you're absolutely true. That's absolutely true. So it's really the field strength.
Yeah.
The field strength is also has these. The field strength is also expandable in terms of the generators. And strictly speaking, you're absolutely right. It's only the field strength that actually transforms as the adjoint representation. That extra non-tensorial term in the gauge field spoils it. You're absolutely right. That's a good point.
So why is that bit there?
That bit is there because you have to make a choice in life. You either have to have, so remember the original reason we introduced the gauge field was that the partial derivative, if we had just used the partial derivative, if the field transforms tensorially under the gauge group, if the field transforms to phi goes to u phi with no other funny business, then the partial derivative of phi does not transform like a tensor. And so how do you fix that? You want to fix that non-tensorial transformation law of the partial derivative. So you end up having to add something that also doesn't transform tensorially so that the two mistakes cancel each other, basically. The point is that the real object is capital D. In some sense, you just shouldn't think about partial and A separately. If you want to think tensorially, you should only think about their combination capital D. That thing does transform tensorially. That thing does, honest to God, transform in the adjoint representation as U D mu U. But if we try to separate this thing into partial plus A, that's when both of those two pieces transform non-tensorially, but the non-tensorial bits cancel between them. Yeah, okay. Any other questions? Okay. Oh yeah.
When you say transforming tensorially, is that like just in terms of what leaves the action invariant? Is that what that means here?
I should have said that. Yes. Okay. Whenever I say that something transforms like a tensor, what I mean is that it transforms. If I have a group and every element G is mapped to an element U of G, then I say that an object transforms like a tensor under that group if all that happens is that it gets hit by one or more copies of U. So for example, in GR, you know, if you have a vector that gets hit by one, in GR, normally you're talking about how things transform under coordinate transformations, and so your matrix lambda here is like lambda mu nu is equal to the matrix of partials relating the new coordinates and the old coordinates. So if you have an index with one object here, then it's just hit with one copy of lambda. But you could also, you know, for example, the stress energy tensor has two indices, mu and alpha, and so you have another. When it transforms, you have another gets hit by two copies of lambda to transform it into the new coordinate system. But that's still a tensor. But what it doesn't have is anything except homogeneous linear transformations like this. So a tensor is an object with, concretely, you can say a certain number of indices. And when it transforms, all that happens is that every one of its indices gets hit by a power, gets hit by one of the copy of the matrix that is representing the group under which it's transforming. And so in the standard model, for example, to take another illustrative example, you know, let's say Q up there. Q, I'll explain this more next time, but Q, for example, is an object that carries several different indices. First of all, it's a spinner field, so it carries some spinner index. Let's call that capital A. But then it also transforms non-trivially under SU3, so it carries some SU3 index. Let's call that alpha. And then it also transforms non-trivially under SU2, so it also carries some SU2 index, which I'm running out of different types of letters, but let's call that A hat. And then under U1, it also transforms, but that's a one-dimensional thing, so I won't write as index. You don't usually write a separate index for that. But so this guy, for example, when it transforms under a Lorentz transformation, it'll get hit by the spinner representation of the Lorentz transformation, and so that'll be some matrix lambda A B that gets contracted with B here. But if I transform under an SU3 transformation, then it'll get hit by some matrix U, alpha, beta, some 3x3 SU3 matrix, which gets contracted with its SU3 index. And under SU2, it'll get some other 2x2 unitary matrix, which gets contracted with its SU2 index. But what doesn't happen is that what I'm not having in the transformation law is anything except some matrices hitting Q. I'm not having plus anything. I'm not having derivatives of Q. It's just taking this vector or matrix or three index object, etc., and the objects in that vector or matrix are just being linearly mixed up with each other. That's what I mean by a tensor. It's just the generalization of the same thing you call a tensor in GR. The only thing is that in GR, you're always talking about one particular group. There's the group of coordinate transformations, and so at every point, the matrix, there's just one matrix you're always interested in, which is this matrix lambda in GR. So there's only one type of index. The only difference here between what you call a tensor in GR and what you call a tensor in gauge theory is that things can carry a bunch of different kinds of indices, because in addition to Lorentz transformations, there's all these different possible internal groups under which the fields can transform non-trivially. Well, I'll try to think. I see from the look in your eyes that that is not entirely clear. So I will try to think of a better way to say that. Maybe for the next lecture. Yeah. Okay. Yes.
So, like when you the QL and the LL, you're combining two, like.
So
they just pull the same UL idea.
I'll explain that better next time. So you know, we haven't. It's traditional to. What I'm doing is showing. I really don't need to show this in this. The table would have been more consistent if I didn't. But I'm trying to make contact with particles that people might have heard of. But by the same token, I could here, if I was going to, so what I'm doing is just, this is a two-dimensional representation times a one-dimensional representation. So this is really just two fermions here.
Mm-hmm.
I'm showing them explicitly. Here, if I did the same thing, this is a one-dimensional representation times a three-dimensional representation. So this is three fermions here. If I showed them, I would write dr. Here are the three are usually called red, green, and blue.
Okay, okay.
So here this would be dr red, dr green, dr blue, and here I would have to do both. I would here this is a
okay.
two times three component
yeah,
guy.
Yeah.
So this is six guys. So there's ul red, ul blue, red, ul green,
okay.
dl red, dl.
So you could have made two separate columns with
exactly.
ul yeah.
So I sort of inconsistently expanded some of them and not the others. And in fact, probably that's a good point. Probably next point, just for pedagogy's sake, I should add a second column and fully expand them all. That's a good idea.
And like that's what the hypercharge kind of confused me too. So you just add spin and regular charge, right? Electric charge. That's hypercharge? I just Googled it.
Well, not quite. No. So there's It is true that not ordinary spin. There's actual space-time spin is a separate turns out to be a separate matter. So you're not adding anything about its actual whether it's spin up or spin down according to the rotation group.
Mm-hmm.
But since this SU2, you know. The rotation group in space-time is SO3, but the double cover of that is what spinners, you know, this fact that spinners, you have to rotate them, if you rotate them 360 degrees, they come to back to minus one times themselves, you have to do it twice to get back to the spinners. That's saying they secretly don't transform under SO3, the normal rotation group that vectors transform under, instead they transform under the double cover of SO3, which is SU2. So it so happens that SU2 appears in two important places in the standard model. One is it's the rotation subgroup of the Lorentz group under which spinners transform. So that's ordinary spin. But then it's also this internal subgroup, which has nothing to do with space-time transformations and rotations. But because it's the same abstract group, because they're both the group SU2 abstractly, this one has this name, isospin, which confusingly makes it sound like it has something to do with actual spin. But it doesn't.
But isospin is like the, is not the intrinsic spin? No, it is, yeah, it's the intrinsic.
Isospin, no. So isospin has, so for example, this particle has an intrinsic spin 1/2, which could be up or down.
Yeah.
It also has isospin 1/2, which could be up or down. But this particle has intrinsic, it's also a fermion. So if I say it's a fermion, all the fermions have intrinsic spin 1/2. So this guy also has intrinsic space-time spin 1/2, which could be up or down, but it has no isospin. It has zero isospin. So they're just two separate concepts that happen to be confusingly named as if they are related to each other. And the reason historically that they do have those similar names is because ultimately the group theory, the abstract mathematical group that describes them is the same in both cases.
So what is isospin?
Isospin is this. So in ordinary space-time spin, if a particle doesn't transform, so there's one particle on this list that doesn't transform under rotations. So you say that particle has spin zero. And if a particle does, well, if it transforms in a two-dimensional representation of SU2, you say it has spin 1/2. If it transforms in a three-dimensional representation, you say it has spin 1, etc.
Oh, so like isospin just kind of tells you if it's a fermion or a boson.
No, ordinary spin does. Ordinary spin does.
Oh, yeah.
Or is it space-time spin, exactly. But you basically, but yes. So space-time spin, if you're a boson, you have integer space-time spin. If you're a fermion, you have half integer space-time spin. And in particular, a scalar field is the particular kind of boson that has zero spin. But now, the dimension, here really, The only thing that matters is the dimension of the representation. If it's bigger than one, that says that this field transforms. When you perform an SU2 symmetry transformation, this field does mix up in some non-trivial way. Something happens here. Whereas this field, nothing happens. When you do an SU2 transformation, you just leave that particular field alone in the Lagrangian. So colloquially, you can say, therefore, this guy has isospin because it does transform non-trivially under SU2, whereas this guy doesn't have isospin. It has spin, but no isospin.
So what